This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The United Nations marked its 75th anniversary Monday with its chief urging leaders of an increasingly polarized, go-it-alone world to work together and preserve the organization's most important success since its founding. That's avoiding a military confrontation between the major global powers. Secretary General Antonio Guterres appealed for a revival of multilateralism, the foundation of the United Nations, which was echoed by leaders of countries large and small, rich and poor. But despite largely positive speeches, it was clear that challenges lie ahead in collaborating to beat back the coronavirus pandemic and numerous smaller conflicts from the Middle East to Africa. Canadian police Monday searched an apartment in Montreal suburbs that is linked to the woman arrested for sending its rice and field envelope to the White House and to five other addresses in the state of Texas. U.S. authorities arrested a woman at the U.S.-Canada border near Buffalo, New York, Sunday on suspicion that she sent the deadly poison by mail addressed to the White House. Two sources said she has joint Canadian and French citizenship. The RCMP said police had arrested the woman now believed to be held in Buffalo in early in 2019, but said that he did not have records related to the arrest and referred further inquiries to the FBI. U.S. President Donald Trump met Monday with Judge Amy Coney Barrett at the White House as a conservative jurist and emerged as a favorite to replace the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the U.S. Supreme Court. The start of a monumental Senate confirmation fight over objections from Democrats. This is VOA News. There are now more than 963,000 deaths globally from COVID-19, more than 31.2 million infections. The top U.S. public health agency stirred confusion by posting and then taking down an apparent change in its position on how easily the coronavirus can spread from person to person through the air. But officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say their position has not really changed and that the post last week on the agency's website was an error that had been taken down. It was an honest mistake that happened when a draft update was posted before going through a full editing and approval process, according to Dr. Jay Butler, the CDC's Deputy Director for Infectious Diseases. The White House is urging governors to put aside politics in different states and help promote the awaited coronavirus vaccines as safe and effective. We get more from AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
On a call with the nation's governors, Vice President Mike Pence urged they use their bully pulpits to help reassure the public that vaccines will be safe after a quick but rigorous vetting by the Food and Drug Administration. Pence says his request is non-political, acknowledging the tension of this election season, but vowing no corners will be cut to approve a vaccine. In the private call obtained by the Associated Press, the vice president says the administration doesn't want people undermining confidence in the process. Meanwhile, Connecticut's Democratic governor has created a scientific advisory panel in his state to validate the safety of any vaccines that are released. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
And as people around the world contemplate when they'll be able to vacation again, the cruise line industry is preparing for the surge. Major companies say they will test all passengers and crew for COVID-19 prior to boarding as part of their plan to fight the virus. AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
While no date has been set for cruises to resume, a trade group that represents 95% of global ocean-going cruise capacity says that in addition to COVID tests, passengers and crew will need to wear masks on board whenever physical distancing isn't possible. The CDC has a no-sail order for U.S. waters through the end of the month. The cruise line's International Association Safety Plan will now go to the CDC, which will decide whether to lift the no-sail order, which has been extended twice since March. I'm Shelley Adler.
And you can find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Mali's military junta names transitional president and vice president, but will it satisfy ECOWAS?
We're still waiting to know who will be the prime minister. I think if those two are civilian, it will pass ECOWAS test, provided that the junta revises the mandate of the president and the vice president.
An Ethiopian opposition leader appears in court on terror charges. The water situation in Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo, is worsening by the day. Uganda's school children are set to return to the classroom next month. And Cameroon's opposition party plans to protest today despite heavy security deployment.
We are sure that if the protest go on as planned, we will achieve our goals, because we're asking for the end of the war in the northwest and the southwest of our country.
And processes and methods of regreening Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Of the military junta in Mali says Monday that he will serve as the president in the transitional government. Colonel Assimi Ngoita also said retired Major Colonel Ba Ndor will serve as transitional president. Both men were chosen by a group of 70 electors selected by the military. They will guide an 18-month transition that will lead to elections. They are expected to be sworn in this Friday, September 25th. At their last meeting on September 15 in Aburi, Ghana, leaders of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, said both the president and prime minister should be civilians. Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese human rights activist and political analyst.
We're still waiting to know who will be the prime minister. I think if those two are civilian, it will pass ECOWAS test, provided that the junta revises the mandate of the president and the vice president. You know, the charter that they produce, the power, in fact, was in the hand of the vice president, and ECOWAS asked them to change that. So because we are at the beginning of a process, it's quite difficult to say if the junta is meeting all the criteria set by ECOWAS to lift the sanction. But I need to say that it's quite interesting to see that the head of the junta is becoming the head of the army, because that itself is a very interesting decision, because it means that the junta will be still within the system.
Assuming that the decision from Bamako is not accepted by ECOWAS, I'm wondering what choice or leverage does ECOWAS have? After all, isn't it true that the leadership question in Mali is one that should be made by the people of Mali?
Yes, Malians should make a decision, but Malians, in making their decision, should comply with the obligation they have under ECOWAS treaty. Because choosing who you want is one thing, but making sure that you comply with your obligation under the community law, I think it's very important. And here, the most compelling issue is to make sure that the transition is not led by the military. And I think ECOWAS will not allow Mali to be an exception.
The report said Ndor and Ouita were chosen by a group of 70 electors who were selected also by the military. I am wondering whether the M5 had any role in this selection process.
This question is very interesting, because when I saw the Ouita naming the members of that committee, I was really surprised to notice that it has 7 members of the army and only 2 members of the M5. And the rest is composed of people with disabilities and many other groups. But I think, after all, this is just about selecting who will lead the transition. And the main issue being what will be the purpose of the transition, because they will serve as kind of people who will be supervising, but who will not be very active in the transition. So I think the M5 doesn't want to continue to block the process, but wants to be in the middle of the action. So that's why I think the nomination of the prime minister will be very interesting to look at. and also how the transition will be conducted. Because I think if the army continues to think that they will really play the leading role in this process, I think they're making a big mistake. Because Malians are mobilized, Malians will continue to look at the whole process. This is not just about the aftermath of the election. This is about rebuilding the state. This is about doing things that will really lead to a new Mali.
Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese human rights activist and political analyst. You are speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. The opposition Cameroon Renaissance Movement says plans for a protest in the capital, Yaoundé, will proceed as originally scheduled today, Tuesday. This despite local media reports of heavy deployment of security forces along major roads in parts of the city. But the opposition and civil society groups say they expect the protest will be peaceful. Organizers say the protest will seek to demand reforms to the country's electoral commission. They are also calling for an immediate ceasefire in the ongoing conflict in the Anglophone regions to pave the way for dialogue. Ngalu Mitumu Anik Natasha is leader of the youth wing of the Cameroon Renaissance Movement Party. She tells VOA's Peter Clotty that her group is not deterred by the deployment of heavy security forces.
The protest will still go on Tuesday as planned, even though the government has deployed vast and terrible military forces everywhere on the road. Yes, we are determined to protest as planned.
Do you think what you are demanding will be achieved with this protest?
We are sure that if the protests go on as planned, we will achieve our goals, because we're asking for the end of the war in the northwest and the southwest of our country, and we're asking for the revision of the electoral code. So we're sure that if Cameroonians go out to protest massively, we're sure that something will achieve something.
But Anik, local media is reporting that majority of Cameroonians are against the protest, and they express concern that the deployment of heavy security forces, there could be a clash between security forces and supporters of the opposition groups embarking on this protest. Are you not concerned about the security of these people that you have called to protest in Yaoundé on Tuesday?
Actually, there will be no violence if the army does not harm the population. This is a pacific protest. That is, we are not going out with the intention of breaking the laws. We are not out for an insurrection, as the government wants the worldwide opinion to think. We are out to ask for our rights.
Ms. Ngalu, several protests have been held in Cameroon, particularly in Yaoundé, demanding all sorts of things, including political reforms, electoral reforms, institutional reforms, and the likes. What do you think is going to be different this time?
I think there will be a difference, because it is not more like the regime made people think, that it is a confrontation between a political party and maybe the regime or the government. Now it is the Cameroonians' concern to go out and ask for their rights. Even the international concern towards this protest of the Tuesday, the 22nd of September, is different. The intensity with which and the gravity of the impact of this protest on the political, social, and economic life of the country shows that there will be a difference. I am sure that people will come out, ask for their rights, and this government will have to grant or at least listen to people's will. Personally, unlike other protests, I and political friends, our leaders, Maurice Kamto, were arrested on the 26th of January 2019, and we were jailed for 9 months. The people were not really interested in what was happening, because it had not taken that intensity. People were not really concerned. The Cameroon situation now is such that the government has to listen to people.
Ngalu Mitumu Anik Ntacha is the leader of the youth wing of the opposition Cameroon Renaissance Movement. She was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Ethiopian opposition leader Jawar Mohammed and 22 others appeared in court yesterday, Monday, to face charges of terrorism and other crimes. Jawar, a media mogul and outspoken critic of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, was arrested in June following the killing of popular singer Hakalu Hundessa, a champion of the Oromo ethnic group. Political analysts say the charges are likely to raise tensions in Oromia, Ethiopia's largest and most populous region. Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
In November last year, Jawar, who runs a television channel, the Oromia Media Network, met with Prime Minister Abiy in hopes of convincing him to revise his nationalist agenda and favor more political autonomy for Ethiopia's diverse collection of regions, including Oromia. But the two men's relationship fell apart, and Jawar joined the opposition Oromo Federalist Congress. He began campaigning against the government inside packed sports stadiums. Then, in late June, after the death of Hachalu Hundessa, Jawar and some of his loyalists joined the body en route to the singer's hometown, Ambo. Someone, it is unclear who, decided to hold a ceremony for the body in Addis Ababa. When a standoff between federal security officials and Jawar's supporters ensued, a police officer was shot dead and Jawar later arrested. Authorities have now charged Jawar with inciting ethnic violence through his television channel and speeches. He's also charged with telecommunications fraud and terrorism. The charges could prevent Jawar from running in Ethiopia's upcoming but still unscheduled elections. William Davison, a senior analyst for International Crisis Group, says Jawar's potential absence could undermine the polls.
Unless prosecutors provide convincing evidence during this upcoming trial that these Oromo opposition leaders are guilty of these grave charges, then if they are convicted, there will undoubtedly be a widespread public perception, especially in Oromia, that the Ethiopian government is once again engaging in politicized prosecutions here. That will, of course, make it very difficult for the authorities to run a successful election next year, an election that will be considered fair by all major actors and constituencies, again, particularly in Oromia. And if that is the case, the vote will not really be the landmark democratic moment that was hoped for.
Among those who appeared in court on Monday was Bekele Gerba, deputy chairman of the OFC, who has also been charged with inciting violence and terrorism. His son, Samuel Bekele, told VOA that after attending several pre-trial court sessions, he is convinced his father's case has been politicized.
We expect them to come up with something a bit believable. But they just pulled the old trick. They recycled the old trick and they accused them of terrorism, telecommunication fraud and other things. But it is aimed to eliminate the formidable political opponents of Abiy Ahmed. I don't think they're going to convict them if they follow the rule of law.
Prime Minister Abiy last week said that Ethiopia is fully committed to its democratic transition, which he began in March 2018. Writing in The Economist magazine, he reaffirmed the importance of a free press, a vibrant civil society, an independent judiciary, and an open political space. But he also stated that certain individuals and groups in Ethiopia are harvesting the seeds of inter-ethnic and inter-religious division and hatred. Jawar's lawyer, Kadir Bulo, said Monday that both Jawar and Bekele were merely expressing their rights by giving a voice to millions belonging to the Oromo ethnic group.
What Jawar and others have been doing for the past 2 days, they were challenging by through the legal channels, right? That means they were organizing their people so that their interests to be secured in legal and only legal ways.
Jawar and other defendants are scheduled to appear back in court on Thursday. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 22nd. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says some schools, the international airport and places of worship can reopen next month, ruling out a complete reversal of the COVID-19 restrictions. His announcement came despite a spike in cases in recent weeks, especially in parts of the capital, Kampala. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
It's been about 6 months since schools were closed as part of the measures to curb the spread of COVID-19. Museveni said only a fraction of the 15 million students can return to school on October 15th. The rest will have to wait. until January. He says those returning are a manageable number that can be ably monitored for observance of COVID-19 standard operating procedures.
The total number of finalists is 1.2 million learners out of the total of 15 million, i.e. less than 10%. Therefore, each group of finalists will have bigger space for social distancing, whether they are in the day schools or boarding schools. If they follow the SOPs, they will be safe.
Museveni has also given a green light for churches to reopen, but with a specified number of congregates and days of worship, no nights.
Individual prayers or confessions with priests or counseling with the necessary SOPs. Prayers and fellowships whose numbers do not exceed 70, and by observing all the other SOPs, we think these ones are safe. Night prayers and transnights are, however, not allowed. The regular large gatherings of prayers and preachings of Sundays and Fridays will be considered at a later stage, depending on how the disease will be evolving.
The president also ordered the reopening of the international airport and land borders for tourists and returning Ugandans who have a negative COVID-19 test certificate.
The tourists will be driven straight from the airport to their destinations or to designated transit hotels that are set aside for that purpose. Business delegations should also be handled in the same way by local partners. The returning Ugandans who have got the negative results will be allowed to go home, not stay in the quarantine, and the Minister of Health will only get their addresses for follow-up.
Entebbe International Airport officials say all is set for safe reopening. Vian Lugia, the public affairs manager for the Uganda Civil Aviation Authority, listed the precautions.
One of them is the installation of automated sanitizers. We have erected glass shields to separate passengers from the officers handling them. We are enforcing mandatory wearing of masks, observance of social distance, marking the terminal building to show where you should stand. We have erected executive tents at the arrivals to help us with the screening of passengers. In case any are observed to have symptoms, there is an area to handle them appropriately. At every entry to the terminal, there are temperature guns to screen anyone entering the airport for temperature.
However, some school officials think it's premature for them to reopen. Paul Etiang is a school director.
But our problem is social distancing, whereby we shall necessitate the government to construct more classes in schools and let the government give the head teachers at least a way they can maintain the structures which are there, even the furniture be added to schools, even, for example, like we need more latrines, we need more classes. So let the government at least extend the reopening of the school after constructing more classes.
Uganda has recorded 6,287 COVID-19 cases and 63 deaths. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The water situation in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe's second largest city, is worsening by the day, with private companies selling the precious liquid from boreholes by the bucket. Ade Gondo has more on the story.
Simela Dube, the city's engineering director, says Bulawayo needs 150 megaliters of water a day. He told a stakeholders meeting in June that it was getting only about 60% of that from three supply dams and Rochester Farm. Major droughts in four of the last 8 years have cut the water levels at the dams, and problems with aging equipment and power shortages have worsened the situation. The city council stopped adhering to a 144-hour weekly watch schedule a few weeks ago, citing the dire situation. It appears far from resolution, despite consultations on possible solutions and several visits by national officials. It couldn't have come at a worse time, given the COVID-19 regulations, which require regular hand washing and other sanitary measures, and plans to send students back to school soon. The capital, Harare, is also dealing with acute water shortages. Bulawayo residents queue for hours to fetch water from unsavory places, mobile tankers and boreholes scattered around the high-density suburbs. In the Kelvin industrial area, a company is selling water from a borehole by the 20-liter bucket. Tando Dube, a mother of four, says she needs 200 liters of water a day but can only afford 160 and has to spend hours fetching it despite her fears of COVID-19.
The situation is tough for us. Can't get water in time.
A few months ago, several residents in the suburb of Luveve died from suspected contaminated water. But Abile Dlamini lives in Kauri Park, one of the hardest hit areas. She says she has seen residents resorting to using water from best sewer pipes, increasing the health risks.
I've seen people fetching that water, and when asked where they're using the water, they say it's for gardening and for flushing the toilet. But for consumption, they have to join all cures or where there is a bowser.
The city council is proposing Kami Dam as an alternative source of water, but it was rejected in 2013 and again at the June meeting because many bodies were reportedly dumped there in the 1980s amid mass killings. Kumbulani Maphosa of Blawai Water Action Bua spoke on the proposal.
With Kami Dam, there are problems that we have. So why are we tampering with the scene of crime and extracting the bodies if they are there? How do we heal when we are treating our own people? Whether it was with the regime, whether it was post-independence, I don't care. But so maybe let's look at that also before we go to Kami. Then also, maybe if you recycle, why don't you recycle and take it to industry? But let it not be forced into our tapes.
But Dube says Kami Dam has to be considered and that a private sector company claims it has the technology to treat the water sufficiently. Meanwhile, the situation is deteriorating amid concerns that more may die without age and action. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Blawaya.
As West Africa experiences a record-breaking rainy season in places such as Senegal and Guinea-Bissau, agroforestry and evergreen agriculture are increasingly being looked at as tools that can help farmers and livestock herders increase resiliency against the unpredictable effects of climate change. Susan Chamba, project manager for Regreening Africa, spoke with Ricky Stryak about their methods and progress.
Trees are an important part of the agricultural production in terms of increasing soil fertility, in terms of increasing infiltration of water into the ground, and also capturing water from really lower water table up to the and bringing up to the layers that the crops can be able to access it. So it's an absolute important strategy to have trees in the cropping systems, but also because we know trees provide multi-purpose benefits to households, including fruit trees that can be able to provide food and income to the households, but also resources that can be able to be sold and marketed, and therefore cushioning households against during times of hardships such as drought periods, prolonged drought periods. In terms of looking at in the future, we need to also understand how climate change is affecting the trees and the tree species, and perhaps some of the tree species that we see currently being planted in the Sahel or growing in the Sahel may change as a result of climate change. And
given specific examples like the record-setting rainy season that's going on in West Africa, have you seen any on-the-ground research that's happening on your side, how, for instance, this rainy season is affecting what might need to be planted differently than before?
With the increased rains, one of the things that we are trying to do, it's not just necessarily trying to get new trees in the system, but also it's how we can be able to restore these degraded ecosystems. And so in the Sahel, we are experimenting with what we call direct seeding. So areas that are completely degraded and you cannot even use the natural regeneration methods because we are not certain that there's enough germplasm in material, either in terms of seeds or enough rootstock to be able to generate naturally. What we are doing now is to experiment with farmers with different kind of tree species. So we are seeing more options as a result of the increased rainfall, but also we are really looking at the long-term in engagement with the farmers in terms of not just now, once the seeds have germinated, how can we ensure that the survival rate beyond the seedling phase is guaranteed?
That was Susan Chamba, project manager for Regreening Africa. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Nairobi. And that's it for this Tuesday, September 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping you will have a great day.
Border Crossings.
Voice of America's Request Hour brings you an hour of great music and an escape from the news headlines, which aren't too good every single day. Tune in at 1500 Universal to Border Crossings. Make your requests by calling 202-619-2077, and we'll forget about all of our troubles and enjoy an hour of great music. Tune us in, Border Crossings, on the Voice of America.